just getting marked up.
Call the meeting of the Energy Policy and Finance Division to order. First order of business would be to approve the minutes from March 17th. Chair would entertain a motion.
So moved.
Do so. Representative Falk moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of their adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. First item on the agenda this morning is House File 3641. Representative Welty. Representative Welty, would you care to move your bill?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I move House File 3641 at this time. And members and Mr. Chair, this legislation, House File 3641, has to do with the seabed legislation that's currently in statute. At the core of the seabed or community wind is the belief that Minnesota communities, landowners, and residents, workers, and their families should benefit from the vast wind resources and the jobs and wealth that they create. This bill continues this original vision. It also provides for common sense changes in the current statute that clarify how seabed benefits are calculated, increases competition to keep seabed power priced attractively, and attract green energy jobs to our state and provide for accountability. So here is what this bill really does. This bill retains the threshold of 51% community benefit in the current seabed statute. The current statute includes the term other local entities as a community benefit. In practice, this has included those things that you see included in this bill as qualifying beneficiaries and qualifying revenues from construction to landowner payments to local taxes paid as a result of the energy that is created. Think of this as a bill that follows the money. It says that we should track the dollars paid to Minnesota residents and businesses to confirm that the 51% threshold has been reached. The legislation in front of the committee encourages economic growth in our state by sending a message that we are a good place to do business for green energy manufacturing. This bill includes another piece that has been missing from our current statute, a process for compliance. We would ask that seabed developers come back to the Office of Energy Security after the final financial structure is established and before construction to demonstrate one more time that the 51% community benefit threshold has been met. This bill does introduce the idea of net present value. It's a common and valuable tool for analyzing investments by recognizing the time value of money, making it possible to evaluate long-term investments, such as the term of the power purchase agreement. Finally, this bill has the potential to benefit consumers through lower seabed wind power prices by enabling multiple seabed structures to compete for utility power purchase agreements. This bill retains the flip model and the wind ownership we have known as seabed. It also provides Minnesota landowners and investors additional options and investment choices when negotiating a seabed project to best fit their economic needs. I appreciate the committee's consideration of this legislation, and as you see in your packets, we have strong support, and there are letters of support in there. And at this time, I'm going to move two amendments, and these amendments are offered because there are members of the committee who had some concerns with this legislation, and many of you have already been consulted about this, and so we took into consideration some of those concerns. And the first amendment that I'd like to offer, Mr. Chair, I would move the A2 amendment at this time.
That motion is before us. Representative Welty, you want to explain the amendment?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. line 1.8 through 110 of this amendment, what it does is it further clarifies the definition of the beneficiary. Some people had concerns that this may be opening up the definition and it might allow outside investors outside of Minnesota to come in. And so what we are doing is really narrowing the definition because it is not our intent to have shell companies or outside entities coming in to invest. And then 1.14 through 1.22, if you look at subdivision 10 that's currently in the bill, this tweaks it a little bit, and it just more clearly describes the process of a seabed project and what it must go through to determine the eligibility. And again, this is about making sure that the seabed projects that are approved meet the goals and the requirements set forth in this legislation.
Any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to now move the A6 amendment. The A6 amendment, members have had concerns about removing the threshold on lines 2.34 of the original bill. We struck the language regarding the 15% share, you know, saying that one entity couldn't have more than 15% share. We are putting this language back in. So what we're saying is that no entity can have more than 15% of the benefits. So we're leaving that original intent in place.
Discussion to this amendment. Oh, great.
Yeah. And I will just state that the written language there, it just adds further clarification to our intent to make sure that no shell companies can be formed in Minnesota to take advantage of this seabed legislation.
Yeah, I should mention that an earlier version of the A6 amendment had been distributed, and the amendment that Representative Welty is moving includes the written language on page 1.3, or the handwritten language on line 1.3. Which reads, including any parent company or subsidiary of the qualifying beneficiary. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Welty, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to Blake Nixon from Geronimo Wind, and he will provide you with a little bit more of a description of why this bill is before us. And then after Blake gets done with his testimony, instead of opening it up for questions, I think I would prefer to go on to Linda Taylor and to Byron Christopher before we open it up to questions, and maybe have all three of them field questions, because I think their testimonies are going to kind of go in the same direction, and I think it would make the most sense to do it that way, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. Mr. Nixon, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thank you for your time. Representative Welty, thank you very much for your leadership in offering this bill. Members of the committee, thank you for your leadership in broadly renewables and wind energy to this date. My name is Blake Nixon. I'm the president of Geronimo Wind Energy. We're located here in Edina, Minnesota. We are developers of wind projects throughout the upper Midwest, but with a very high concentration of those projects in Minnesota. To date, we have developed two projects that have been built and are operating. They're both in southwestern Minnesota. Both of them are seabed certified projects. So we believe that in practice we are very well attuned to the realities of the seabed statute as they exist today. The goal that we have seen in this bill is to get seabed working again, very simply. We have proposed with Representative Welty some common sense changes that really simply try to reflect the current business practice within the industry without trying to change anything of great significance or do anything to incentivize any behaviors that are not desired in the original intent of the bill or in the practice in the industry today. The bill proposes three core things. Number one, clarity. To gain clarity on what counts in attaining the 51% benefits that have always been sought, and who can get those qualifying revenues as we have defined qualified beneficiaries. Number two, to create a real compliance mechanism. Today, the compliance mechanism consists of the developer of the project seeking a certification letter from the Office of Energy Security. This may happen 3 weeks ahead of the project going into construction. It may happen 3 years ahead of the project going into construction. And one thing that I've learned in my 5 years in this business is that things change constantly. And the fact that one could attain the only certification needed for seabed very early with the prospect of change highly likely without having a recertification happening once the final terms are together doesn't seem to make much sense. And we think this is a common sense change that will help ensure that the benefits are going to the right people once the deal is finalized. The final piece of the bill is making sure that we measure benefits logically. The introduction of net present value as the way to count the 51% benefits relative to the power purchase agreement that it is compared against is simply as logical as acknowledging that a dollar today is worth more than a dollar in 15 or 20 years. Net present value is the most commonly used financial tool to account for the time value of money and the fact that dollars in near-term periods are more valuable than dollars in long-term periods. That's the end of my prepared testimony. Shall we have the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Nixon. Ms. Taylor, you want to come forward? Taylor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Linda Taylor. I'm the Clean Energy Program Director at Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a nonprofit energy advocacy organization located in St. Paul. Fresh Energy supports enactment of House File 3641. We feel that this bill will help to clarify how seabed projects are structured. It will give greater clarity to the developers, to the Department of Commerce, and to the Public Utilities Commission as we go forward, as well as to utilities that we are expecting to purchase the power from these projects. We understand that the proposers of this bill, partly with our nagging, have been talking to each other and trying to work out the details of how to do this. As you know, this is a long-term effort in Minnesota. The concept of how do we get community renewable energy development projects done? How do we get the kinds of benefits localized to the communities and to Minnesota? In general, we support increasing both the number and the diversity of seabed projects across the state. We feel very strongly that seabed projects can form a substantial portion of the new clean energy economy for the state and can provide a viable model for other states. And we think these clarifications will help us get there. Thank you.
Ms. Taylor, is it just to clarify, are you and your organization in support of the bill then as amended?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are in support of the bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Welty,
turn it over to Byron Christopher. He's a landowner. Byron has actually developed a seabed project, and then he was moving on to his second seabed project, and I'll let him give you the history of that, and then he can tell you why he is here in support of this legislation.
Mr. Chair and representatives, my name is Byron Christopher. I'm here with my wife, Kathy, in the second row. And we're from a little town in southwest Minnesota called Worthington. And it's of course, the turkey capital. It's windy down there, and we farm down there. A few years back, me and my two cousins decided that we'd like to get in the wind business, so we hired Dan Jewell to help us develop the project, and we put up a 6-megawatt project, which was just before seabed came into effect. So it was put up like a few months before seabed bill came in. Then a couple of years went by, and Kathy and I decided that we wanted to develop our own project. So we hired an attorney from St. Paul here by the name of Mr. Kevin Wally to help us, guide us through that project. And Kathy and I then put up a 20-megawatt project, and this was a seabed project. And that went, that started turning about June 1st of 08. So a little time went by. Well, in between that time, we just thought, you know, it'd be nice to have another project. And so we went into the next project, 20-megawatt project, and started doing that. And as we got into that project, we realized that we were not going to be capable of finishing that project. It's the most stressful thing we've ever done in our life. There is a mental stress that you can't believe. There is financial stress that you can't believe. And we had to sell that project. We just couldn't take it anymore. So we got out of that project. We sold that project to Geronimo here in Edina, Minnesota. That is also a seabed project. That will be a 20-megawatt project also, if and when it gets finished. I personally feel that the new bill is important. It's like fine-tuning your car. Every once in a while you have to do that. And the way wind energy has changed from 10 years ago till now, things seem to have gotten a little bigger as they go. And the bill that's in front of us is a good bill, and we do support that bill. So, are there any questions?
Are there any questions for Mr. Christopher or previous witnesses?
At this time, Mr. Chair, maybe we might as well just finish up the testimony with Dan Jewell, and then members can ask questions of any one of those testifiers.
Representative, we have Mr. Bolter from Kraus Anderson on the list.
He will not be testifying today. Was unable to make it. Since he's been, this was the third time we scheduled this hearing, we had one drop out, but just want you to all know, though, that Byron Christopher has been here, been staying up here, and he's from Worthington, so he made the trip.
And we do apologize for the delays, but unfortunately that's kind of standard operating procedure. Mr. Jewell.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dan Jewell. I'm from Woodstock, Minnesota. I'm chairman and CEO of Jewell Wind. We do community-based development projects. We help farmers and small business get into the wind power game. I'm here to support this bill, 3641, as amended. I think that there's a need for the department to have clarification on the seabed. It's been a bit fuzzy-wuzzy for them, and they've had a hard time trying to get letters to folks who want to be participating in seabed for qualifying language or to qualify. And I think this does clarify that, and I commend Representative Wilty and his efforts to get this done. I do always have concern, being one of the original people involved in the seabed and the community-based development, that we're not opening up the floodgates, because the whole essence of this stuff was to try to keep and protect some of our natural resource, our wind energy, and use it as an economic development tool for our farmers and small business people that live in rural Minnesota, and not just give it all away to foreign multinational corporations. And hopefully we can still protect that and keep this movement going, because I do feel very strongly, and I always have, that wind energy can be a great economic development driver for rural Minnesota if we keep our energy dollars in our communities and we keep the construction dollars in our communities. It can really add a lot to it. And it's long-term revenue and long-term value for our state, and we really want to see it, and we keep moving ahead. And hopefully this bill will help do that, in the fact that it does that clarification in the qualifying language. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jewell. Representative Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for either Mr. Jewell or Mr. Nixon. We're talking about community ownership as being the overarching goal, I guess, of CBED. But I'm thinking about the original, what I would consider the original community ownership, and that would be stock certificates in a local power company. Basically capitalism at work here. Before we invented this new tool, one of the beautiful things about just common shares, common stock, was the downside risk was limited. You're limited to your losses only to the extent that you put money into the company. You shared in the upside, the downside was limited to your actual investment. Is that the way the CBED thing works too? If you organize a CBED deal and you bring in the local veterinarian or the local barber or whoever, can you explain the risk and reward limitations, either one, because you're both CBED developers, I believe. But
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Jewell.
Yes, they are limited just by the sheer fact that these are all formed under LLCs, and so you're limited to what you put into the assets of the LLCs. Your risk is limited to that. It does not encumber all of your assets. And when we first started looking at this and setting up, how do we do this for farmers who need to maintain a credit line to keep putting their crops in the ground, we did not want any of this to encumber or impair their ability to continue their lines of credit and their jeopardize their personal assets to become wind developers.
Representative Beard.
Thank you. Part of the structure, I think, of what we've done here is, because we front-loaded, they're all 20-year contracts, if I understand correctly, we front-loaded the rates to be higher in the first 10 than in the last 10. And then there's a thing called the flip that I know Mr. Nixon was trying to explain to me the other day. After the flip, who owns the assets with the reduced cash flow and the increased maintenance? How does that risk balance out? Maybe Mr. Nixon, whoever wants to take a shot at it. I'd like us to understand exactly who we're putting on the line here.
Okay. Mr. Jewell.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, once you get past the flip, the flip was designed because the reason for the flip to begin with mm-hmm. was the fact that our federal government put tax incentives on the table mm-hmm. to make wind energy possible through a production tax credit. You and I, as average citizens, are not eligible for that credit. We're eligible for it, but we can't really use it because it's subject to the passive income rules and the alternative minimum tax rules. And so the flip was designed to help farmers and small business people who can't use the credit still own these projects by bringing in a tax equity partner who stays in for basically 10 years through the life of the tax credit period, and then there's a flip at the end where the ownership structure flips. The IRS has put out safe harbor rules on that flip structure, so it's all okayed by them. And the idea is that, yes, the power contracts are front-loaded to allow debt service in the earlier years, because the debt was also timed with the equity, the 10-year equity. And so once the debt is retired, the amount of net cash that is there is quite large from the standpoint of being able to take care of any potential maintenance issues that come up, plus the line items in the expense budget cover maintenance and warranties through insurance, and also just cash that's targeted for that in it. And so the outside end of it, obviously these are machines, and we all know what machines do. They have a tendency to break when you need them the most. But we feel that hopefully we have built enough in there to protect the long-time investment of the project through those cash flows. Because again, once the debt is retired, then there's a fair amount of cash that's targeted to take care of that. Hope that helped.
Last question.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I may add a little bit to Mr. Jewell's testimony. Though it's allowed in the tariff that front-loading may occur, it's not necessarily the case. You know, for instance, in practice, one of our contracts is front-loaded and one of our contracts is not. So that's point number one. It's not necessarily that way. And I would say in practice, it's moving more towards flat contracts. That's my opinion. I don't know if that's fact, but that's what I see in the market. The second piece that I would offer is that our bill does enable business models other than the flip, while not discriminating against the flip. It gives local investors, local owners, other participants, you know, such as the landowners themselves, to participate in different manners, such as revenue sharing, et cetera, if they did not want to take that risk. And I think the best way I can describe that is in one of our transactions, we were given that option to have a large, consistent revenue share or have the more traditional flip structure. And due to the current statute and the fact that it treats revenues on a gross basis, meaning a dollar in year 20 is treated the same as a dollar today, in order to qualify in good faith with the 51% statute that exists today, we did not really have a choice. We had to take flip, which is a riskier set of cash flows, but they're bigger. So it's good for people who are willing to take risk, but it has a significantly more reward.
Representative Beard.
That was very helpful, but just you raised one other issue, Mr. Nixon. After the when you do a flip, if you do a flip, then once the entity that can use the federal tax credits and incentives, once they're satisfied, are they actually gone then from the ownership model and it's a completely local operation then? Not necessarily.
Mr. Chair, Representative, generally not in practice, but they do flip to a relatively small minority ownership stake. There are IRS rules, I believe, that actually insist that they keep at least 5% to qualify under the tax credit laws that exist at the federal level. But it does flip to, in a majority sense, to the local owner in the flip transaction, and usually it's a very large majority.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, just a quick word of thanks to Representative Welty for his thoughtful approach to the bill. I know it's a complicated issue, and I appreciate all the time that you put in. I have two questions. The first, I think, is for Mr. Jewell or Mr. Nixon about some discussion that I've heard either to limit the number of projects under the new approach to sort of take a wait-and-see attitude or limit the size of potential projects. Just I was hoping that that you might share your thoughts on the cautions that we've heard about the new approach and whether we should treat it as a pilot.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have had those discussions. I believe that the goal of CBED fundamentally, as you've heard from our Representative Welty, myself, others who have testified, is to ensure that as many dollars that come out of the pockets of Minnesota ratepayers to go towards projects in wind will come back into Minnesota pockets in whatever reasonable qualified revenue sources that they can. So my opinion is that if we're going to incentivize CBED to make sure that of the wind that will get built here one way or another, regardless, let's put together the appropriate mechanisms to incentivize that 51% come back into Minnesota to the proper beneficiaries that are well-defined with a real form of compliance to ensure it actually occurs. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question directly, but from an intent perspective, I think that's the overarching goal of CBED, and I don't think that capping that does anything positive in terms of bringing the money going towards wind in this state back into Minnesota. I think that it would have a contrary effect, and we should avoid doing that.
Representative Kalin, just to that, that issue has been brought up, and a couple things just to think about. If, for instance, there was an amendment that was initially offered to cap at 20 megawatts, and if you think about it, why would we want to only say that projects under 20 megawatts would have to meet this 51% threshold of that those dollars flowing back into Minnesota? If it's going to be a project of 40 or 60 megawatts, which a lot of projects are now going to because of scale, there's, you know, of course, economies of scale, then why wouldn't we want a 60-megawatt project or an 80-megawatt project to also have to meet that threshold of 51% of that benefit coming back into Minnesota? And I don't know, the other issue there is we already do have seabed projects in the state that are in excess of 20 megawatts. There is currently no cap. And so why at this point in time would we want to implement a cap for projects that already exist?
Mr. Jewell. I would just like to say that I think that that 20 megawatt came from a brain hiccup that I had in speaking with some of the representatives about this thing, because my concern, basic concern originally when I read the bill was I didn't want to open up the floodgates again. We're trying, you know, the whole essence of this is again to try to protect community-based development in Minnesota from the big multinationals. And so, you know, and 20 megawatts was just a number that was just thrown out just as a mindset, because most communities don't want to do projects over $40 million. And so that's what it was. And I think the fixes that we have put into the amendments kind of take care of some of those issues that I had with it, and hopefully that we'll be able to still maintain the integrity of seabed in the existing language without having to put a cap on it.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Jewell, your comments actually lead me right to my one remaining concern, and I'm not clear on it. Seabed has been the area of energy law I think I've known the least about until this bill. The deletion of the transfer prohibition, the sale prohibition on line 3.23 to 3.24, part of me understands why it makes sense. But I also wonder if we're kind of letting a gap in the levy, opening up a gap in the levy and kind of letting the erosion of seabed continue if we do this transfer. And I'll just share my one concern with that. I actually think that it's a good idea to allow for the open sale. If we're trying to, as Representative Welty and I had a conversation before about, is the goal of seabed only to get the future revenue from the project, or is it to create capital and opportunity and to sort of say it's Minnesota capital and let people do what they, let the owners or beneficiaries do what they want to do with that gain? How do we know that if I were to come in and sell or buy your project, Mr. Nixon, your seabed project, I don't know, I would still have a PPA. I would get the benefit of your PPA, but yet will I still have to certify or recertify? And where is the language that says I have to recertify that it is a seabed project?
Mr. Nixon?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. A couple of thoughts. First of all, you sort of answered it in your question. You know, do we want to restrict? Mr. Christopher is the perfect example from accepting a offer to effectively prepay what he expects to get over a 20-year period of time today. And I think the answer is no. Certainly, in my opinion. Secondly, in business practice, the contracts that each of us signs in a PPA with the off-taker deal with these issues. Number one, you generally, and I'd almost venture to say almost always, we all have a term in your legal contract that says if you're going to sell your interest, you must notify your off-taker. Generally, they have the ability to disallow that. and then if they felt that it jeopardized or lost the seabed status, you would have a penalty in your PPA. Your price would be reduced or some other monetary penalty to you. So there are already mechanisms in practice in the contracts from the off-takers who have bought a seabed project's power for a particular reason, because they want a seabed project's power. The last thing that I'll offer is that, you know, there's nothing currently in the statute that says that a non-qualifying owner can't own it today. So it's somewhat of a moot point in today's current statute from a technical standpoint. I think that's the least important, but those are my three points that I'd like you to have on that.
So, Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure I fully understand the mechanics that the seabed obligation for the utility purchasing the power, that if I'm, you know, if I'm the, if I represent, you know, Global Power Incorporated and I want to come in and buy your seabed project, that the utility purchasing, you know, the utility with which I've you've secured a PPA, which I would be assuming would walk me through again that one security, what the utility's question would be and why it couldn't happen now, why the PPA contractor, you know, the purchaser of your power, why they couldn't sell to Global Power Inc. or whoever.
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now, if a first of all, the utilities don't have an obligation to buy any seabed power. So those that choose to do so are doing so for a reason, which I can't speculate as to what. But we'll just assume that it's because they want to buy seabed power. Therefore, in the contract, you know, they will have a term that says if you sell your interest in this project, you know, saying to me, you know, if my company or me individually, if we were supposed to sell our interest in the project, we would have to notify them. They would generally have some rights as to whether or not that transfer would be allowed, number one. And then number two, they would have a commercial interest typically in that contract, that if they thought it was being sold to someone or some entity that would disqualify it from seabed status, which, assuming they bought it under a seabed contract, that'd be valuable to them, they would have a commercial incentive to reduce your power price in that contract to account for the fact that you've changed the game on them. So those number of things are, you know, business practice today that, you know, in reality constrict or restrict the ability to sell from a qualifying beneficiary to a non-qualifying beneficiary.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question would be for Dan Jewell, and perhaps Linda Taylor might want to address it. But I would like to have you just talk a little bit about what your thoughts are on, you know, the fact that given the current economic situation, which hasn't been real conducive to a lot of business development, and similarly, if there's not more development, perhaps there's less energy use at this point in time than might have happened if the economy hadn't tanked. I would like to know what your thoughts are on how you think seabed would have been progressing minus the economic downturn. You know, so are we making a change due to an economic problem or a problem that's inherent within the program that merely needs to be adjusted? Thank you.
Mr. Jewell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Saylor, unfortunately, I did break my crystal ball on the way in, so but you're right. The economics, it's a very fluid dynamic, the economics of energy and wind energy and how it's all transpiring. And you have to remember that one thing that we have to look at from the standpoint of Minnesotans and ratepayers in the state is we've been building everything but power plants and transmission lines for 30 years, and we need to find energy somewhere. And if we can use our wind resource as an economic development driver. That's why we're doing seabed in that case. The other thing, too, that I think we need to think about in today's economic world of wind energy, that the production tax credit in the stimulus program was changed, where there is now a 30% grant in lieu of the tax credit. And so it's basically a net present value upfront payment. Instead of taking the tax credit for 10 years, you get a 30% of the project value in an upfront cash grant, which really opens up the door more for community development, because then we don't have to go to the tax equity players as much and have them come in and to extract tax values and do the flip structure and do all of these things to make it still work economically. And so it's a fluid dynamic, the economics of wind energy, and we make laws and then we have to adjust, and it's like a constant battle. But you're so right. You know, if we change this now, is it going to hurt or hinder? We think hopefully this will help move seabed along. And again, the economics of it has gotten a little bit better for the short term only, because I guess the cash grant ends at the end of this year unless it gets extended. And then what's going to come after that? You know, there's word that some of the federal job bills that are coming out are going to have incentives for renewable energy, and some of them are going to look at community-based development as a real driver in some of these jobs bills. And so hopefully what we do here today helps set the table for other states and our federal government to look at this as a real value to our rural communities and our rural economies, to turn that old wind into something that can help really help us out. Did that answer your question? No? I don't know.
Representative Taylor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just want to know how much work went into getting seabed a reality in the first place. And, I know it's got some problems now, perhaps. And, of course, everyone wants to make sure that before they take another step that it's absolutely the right one. And since I don't have the crystal ball either, I was hoping you could help out with that. But, you know, that's my concern, is making sure that we really do feel justified in making some changes and that we won't be sorry for later, but one never knows that. Thank you.
Well, Representative Saylor, from my perspective, I think this, that seabed from the very beginning, it has continued to be a work in progress. I don't think we felt when the original bill passed that was the end of it, that we had solved all of the problems relating to community energy development, and I doubt that this bill does that either, but we keep trying. Representative Wallstrom.
Mr. Chair, I guess probably to Mr. Nixon, you talked about one thing that would restrict probably a sale is a monetary change or loss in a sale. How so? And here's what I'm trying to square. One of the reasons we're trying to improve seabed is to get rid of the fallacy or the reality that it's higher cost energy, and therefore this bill moves us in the road of doing that. But if in fact there's a sale is going to cost you money, it doesn't seem to square that we'd want. I contend you don't have to have higher priced seabed. It's just a matter of it's all a turf battle to begin with, and all of these discussions about price are really what we call in law school dicta, which is a polite word for BS. but is that a reality, or what? Square that issue for me, if you could.
Mr. Nixon.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe a seabed project developed, with all of the same benefits of a non-seabed project, such as scale and access to capital and all of those things, doesn't need to be any more expensive than a non-seabed project. Squaring it with the fact that there is a likely, usually a penalty in the offtake contract, I think, has to say that utilities, for whatever their reason, value the fact that wind comes from a community-based project versus a non-community-based project. Whether they'll have to say why they value that, but because they do and because they want to buy seabed wind, they have the penalty in there to make sure that you continue to be seabed wind.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess
Representative West,
if I could just slow the process here on Friday. But so, Mr. Nixon, you're referring to maybe more of a contractual penalty that would be designed to maintain ownership if there was a sale down the road to another party that would comply with seabed ownership. And if not, the contract's going to penalize them because they want to keep it that way.
That's correct. Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess on this point, I'm a little bit nervous about the ability to transfer ownership of projects to non-qualifying owners after you've received your post-certification. I mean, you do talk about the contractual obligations, but there's no statutory obligation that you couldn't. Is that correct?
Mr. Nixon?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that would seem to be correct, yes.
Okay.
If I could add a little color to that.
Mr. Nixon?
Today, the statute doesn't require any qualifying ownership. So if we're talking about the statute, a non-qualifying owner in today's terms can own 100% of a seabed project. That I believe to be fact, and if anybody can state otherwise, that'd be I'd be interested in hearing that.
I'd ask the council to confirm that.
Mr. Ela?
And as you stated, in current statute, are you talking about the bill?
No, in statute prior to the bill that we have in front of you. It purely points to 51% of revenue going to qualifying owners and other local entities. But one, theoretically, though maybe difficult, could qualify by having 51% of the gross PPA revenues over its duration flowing to other local entities without any qualified owners. That's a technical answer to your question, Representative Falk. In reality, I think what's better dealt with in business practice and in contract language, which I believe this to be the case, is better than legislating whether or not Mr. Christopher can sell his project. I'd really hate to have something happen here where my friend Byron and Kathy sitting behind me had somebody, for whatever their reasons, would show up to their kitchen table and offer them $10 million for their interest in their 20-megawatt seabed project when they might not ever think they're going to see $10 million ever. And have us decide that they can't do that doesn't seem to make any sense to me. That's the real reason why I think it should be stricken, and let the contract language from the people who are voluntarily wanting seabed power, the utilities, let them deal with making sure that's that stays the way.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still waiting for him, if Mr. Eliff would be able to give a weigh in on this with his interpretation.
Mr. Eliff, I believe you're being asked to corroborate Mr. Nixon's testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. the notion of other legal entities has been, I think, was a deliberately vague construction when it was first put forth in this bill. And upon hearing Mr. Nixon's explanation of how that 100% could go to those vague entities, I mean, I certainly agree that that's a construction that would fit in with the bill. Whether that's a practical solution, whether that happens in the real world or not, I can't say.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Eliff, would the position with owners having no more than 15%, is that can you completely exclude that or avoid that? Simply, I mean, or would there still be a requirement that if you have more than a two-turbine project, no owner could have more than 15% of the ownership in the turbines that are greater than two to any one single person?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I'm going to have to ask Representative Falk to repeat that.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Eloff, the area where you're in the statute where you're allowed to, as a single owner, own up to two turbines, but in a project with more than two turbines, no owner could have, as my understanding, own more than 15% of the project if it is a greater than two-turbine project.
Let me read the statute, and we can all figure it out collectively. Under the definition of community-based energy development project, it says that the project should have has no single qualifying owner owning more than 15% of a seabed wind energy project unless, one, the seabed wind energy project consists of only one or two turbines, or two, the qualifying owner is a public utility, is a public entity listed under paragraph C, clause 5, that is not a municipal utility. So, again, has no single qualifying owner owning more than 15% of the project unless the project consists only of one or two turbines.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Eloff. I mean, in my interpretation, in order for this, while we can use the language that other local entities can be counted towards the 51%, that ownership requirement, in my opinion, if it's a more than two-turbine project, seems to dictate that you'd have to have no single owner owning more than 15%. That's, maybe I'm interpreting it incorrectly, but that seems to be what it, the statute is saying.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with Representative Falk. We might want to talk. Ask Mr. Nixon his interpretation of that.
Mr. Nixon or Mr. Jewell?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I said before, my interpretation is that it requires no qualifying owners. It just simply states, I don't know what the proper terminology is, in the negative or something, that no single qualifying owner can own more than 15%, and I believe the intent was to ensure that you didn't have a single person owning these wind farms, but it was spread more broadly amongst multiple community members, in the original vision of what the community wind farms would look like. Now, I'll offer one other thing. In practice, we generally start out with the community group owning 1% of the project, and generally an outside entity, the most prominent to date being John Deere and Edison, John Deere out of Iowa/Illinois and Edison out of California being the primary owners of all of these projects, with a contingent flip based upon them earning a rate of return on their investment. So right now we're talking about 1% ownership generally. I know there are other models that have different things, but that's the most commonly practiced seabed financing model to date.
Thank you. Members, we do have to move the agenda along. I'm going to at this time ask if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill. Seeing no one. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm ready to vote too, but I just want to share today's ray of hope that I heard, because I hear testifiers here that are building their business model on a legislatively created business idea, not a marketplace-driven one. We created it in the 5 or 6 years since we've been dealing with it. It's been here every year. If you're looking for certainty, I'm here to tell you there will be no certainty. Those of you that are concerned about ownership models and percentages and nameplate capacity and how many machines, it'll be back again next year, I'm sure. It will continue to be. But here's the ray of hope. I heard one of the testifiers use the word economies of scale. Do you know how that warmed my business-oriented heart? To know that we haven't completely, in all this fog, lost sight of the fact that things like productivity, efficiency, and things like that, even the marketplace putting value on something for somebody who wants to buy it, It gives me hope that maybe there is clarity at the end of the tunnel. Whoever used the word economies of scale, thank you for doing that, Representative Welty. And I appreciate what you're trying to bring clarity out of the mess we've created, but remember, we created it, so it'll be back next year. We'll have more fun with this one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
Mr. Chair, could Mr. Eliff prepare an amendment to remove that reference at all? It just makes me uncomfortable that Representative Beard is optimistic.
Representative Kalin will be duly noted in the minutes. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do understand the need to move along here quickly, but I do have serious reservations about this striking the language that prohibits transfers, and would we be willing to offer the oral amendment on page 323 to 324 to reinstate the stricken language?
Representative Falk, that was already accomplished in the amendment that we adopted earlier.
No. If that was, Mr. Chair, then I am thankful for that, but I was trying to confirm.
Maybe I'm wrong about
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Falk, no, that was not reinstated in the language. I would.
Right. I was looking at the wrong line.
Mr. Chair, instead of doing that now, I would be willing to work with Representative Falk between now and the time that this bill moves to the floor to come up with language that would work. I believe that we can do that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Welty, I appreciate that, but I do think that the committee has seen sufficient reason to worry that although the intention in a contract between the seabed project and the utility may facilitate this or prevent this from happening, there's no statutory protection that once you received your post certification, the day after you couldn't go and sell to another entity. And who knows if the people selling got a fair price that still ensured that 51% of the net present values, as we're now defining it, go to the local community. I am very uncomfortable with this language, and I think that this bill is a major step and how seabed works. I do have serious reservations with it, being the person that worked very diligently on this for basically 4 years to get to the point. Now, I do understand there are good things here, but I also want to make sure that we are preserving the intent which seabed was put together. And seabed is something special. It is community-based energy development. It is not opening it up so anything can be seabed, but there is a limit. And I am willing to work with you on this, but I think that this needs to be here. This is an important part in ensuring protections for rural parts of the state and rural communities and rural projects.
And Representative Falk, you have my commitment to work on this. I don't know if we necessarily, I think that we could go beyond the stricken language and have some other language drafted. We have some language that we've been talking about, and I believe it'll meet your concerns, it'll meet the members' concerns around the table. I would just prefer that we do that as we move this bill along and not right now.
Well, it still gives me, I appreciate that. I'm still uncomfortable. I mean, there's lots of things we could do to fix this, and I think make it better too, but at least at this committee stop, this would give me much more comfort. And from what I've heard, it's just, I want to make sure we're doing this right, and this is a major change, and I think that it's a common sense step that we can take as a protection.
Well, we do have the motion before us. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Falk Amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Chair is in doubt. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed?
You're dead, you go to the bathroom. Did I get rid of his abdomen?
There.
Grinnell.
There being six ayes and six nays, the motion does not prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Faulk, you have my commitment to work on language that, again, will, I think, address everyone's concerns as this moves. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would move that we send, move the adoption of House File 3641 and refer it to the General Register. As amended.
Is there any further discussion to the bill, Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chair, real briefly, Representative Welty, I appreciate you working with the author's amendments and some of these. The last motion, in the interest of looking at that issue closer, I wanted to see that go on. I would like to work with you and Representative Faulk on that as well. And what I told Mr. Eloff here is what I really want to do is get this bill back enrolled as we've amended it and then look at the whole thing together. I think we've made good steps. I don't plan to offer the 20-megawatt cap amendment given the changes we've made, and I'm more comfortable with that direction and look forward to working with you and the proposers and the supporters and people interested in making CBED work, but also not letting the, as Representative Seifert would sometimes say, the 747's nose under the tent. And so look forward to working with you on that.
Representative Westrom, you will have more office visits.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Welty renews his motion that House File 3641, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Welty.
This is an excellent amendable for light bulbs. Yes, it's drafted.
Did you go home last night?
No. No point in going home.
I didn't know if you needed to for your son.
No.
No,
but I called him and went to handle it.
Yes.
But yeah, I actually had Joe Mullery before this event.
It's sort of like
kind of that. Very well. It's $100 a month.
What kind of
portion would be used for individuals who do not, who can't afford it?
No, that's just all.
Oh, it is. Okay. That's what we're going to do.
Thanks for your work. Well, it's tough. Are you obviously?
That's what he said.
Like it.
Do it.
Sounds like,
Members, we're ready to get going. Representative Hilty, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 3493 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register.
Members, Representative Hilty moves that House File 3493 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. That motion is before us. Representative Hilty, to your bill.
And Mr. Chair, also, I believe there has been distributed the A2 amendment, which I need to incorporate into a brief alteration, which would be on line 1.9 of the amendment. After the word usage, insert the word residential.
Members, do you have the oral incorporation in front of you, as Representative Hilty indicated?
Yes.
Any discussion? Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the A2 amendment as with the incorporation.
Members, that motion is before us. Representative Hilty moves adoption of the A2 amendment with the oral inclusion in it. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hilty, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a very simple bill that adds just the one line and one alteration and a number to a current statute. What the bill is intended to do is encourage utilities to in turn encourage the conservation, lower usage of gas and electricity by encouraging them to adopt a rate structure which would reward lower usage on the part of residential customers by offering them a lower rate on the first 400 kilowatts of electricity used. And members, that is the essence of the bill. I have with me at the witness table Ms. Pam Marshall, who can further describe the rationale of the bill.
Ms. Marshall, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Pam Marshall with the Energy Sense Coalition. Just to clarify, the inverted block rate language doesn't have a specific energy usage threshold. It just entertains the notion that utility companies can file such proposals to the Public Utilities Commission, and in fact, encourages them to do so, but puts none of those sort of details in the language that's proposed for this bill. The 300 to 400 kilowatt hour change is really a separate issue from the inverted block rate, and so I just want to talk about that particular section for a second. You have a handout in your packets to give you a bit of context for this. This statute has been around since 1994. It was enacted as a way to supplement benefits from the federally funded energy assistance program, particularly in the era when that program was undergoing significant federal cuts. And the idea was, let's combine some ratepayer and taxpayer assisted programs to make each of those benefits more meaningful and to help folks better able to stay connected to utility service. Several years ago, it was that statute was changed to maintain the flat discount for energy assistance recipients who were 62 years or older or disabled, but to also allow a more targeted benefit to those who were devoting an inordinate percentage of their household income to energy costs. And that program now has been around for several years. It's called Power On. It limits the percentage of income people devote to their electric bills to no more than 3% of household income, and it also includes an arrearage forgiveness component so that there's matching payments each time a customer makes their regular payment. They are able, Xcel will match that payment, and they're able to retire their pre-program arrears over the course of a year or 18 months. And as you can see from your handout, the discount, the flat discount, continues again for fixed income folks who receive energy assistance. The targeted program offers a considerably higher benefit, and recently Xcel won approval to begin paying out the flat discount at the 400 kilowatt hour level, but we're still raising the funds based on 300, and that's the reason for that both Xcel and Energy Sense are seeking this change, so that we simply continue to raise the funds at the same level as that as they are being paid out, so that the targeted part of the program, the Power On program, doesn't have to dramatically reduce the funds that are available, let alone address the 6,700 people that are currently on the waiting list for that program.
Questions from members? Ms. Marshall, thank you for your comments. I believe next on the agenda we have Director Glahn from the Office of Energy Security. Would you like to come down and offer your comments? Director Glahn, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Bill Glahn, Director of the Minnesota Office of Energy Security, Deputy Commissioner of Commerce. And I wanted to thank the author, Chairman Hilty, for incorporating his oral amendment to include the word residential in the A2 amendment. So I'm only going to speak to the A2 amendment, and really just so members understand what it is that we're doing to energy policy by adopting this. I'm not going to speak to the other sections. It's certainly up to the committee what they'd like to do with low income. But I wanted to just have a little bit of a discussion about the inverted block rates, and even limited to residential customers, what it is we're doing in shifting energy policy in the state of Minnesota. We have right now a pilot program going on with CenterPoint Energy, where they have, as part of their last rate case, included inverted block rates as a change to their rate structure. And so we have this pilot project going on. We're gathering data about it. We'll see if it really does do what its proponents claim it will do, and we'll evaluate it. And I think at that point it would be useful to have folks come in and explain how the pilot project went, and see if it would be appropriate at that time to incorporate the concept of inverted block rates into state energy policy. At this time, I think it's somewhat premature with the pilot project going on. But just a little bit of an explanation of typically what you have for a residential customer, for, say, electricity, you have a customer charge, a monthly customer charge, and then for every kilowatt hour that your meter records, you'll pay a flat rate, and that rate might vary during depending on what season it is, a higher rate in the summer, a lower rate in the winter, or depending on where you are in the state, it might be reversed. But it's typically a flat rate for energy use. And what an inverted block rate would do is change the system to something more akin to how we have our progressive income taxes at the federal level, that the more income you make, you pay a higher rate per every dollar you make. So you have a 10% rate, and then it gets ratcheted up to 35% at the higher end. And that's what an inverted block rate would do. So the first few kilowatt hours you would have at a relatively low price, and then the next few, we go, say, from 5 cents to 6 cents to 8 cents. And the idea is to have a punitive effect on higher use. So the more you use, not just you pay more because you're using more, but you pay a higher rate. So it's supposed to be punitive to try to encourage energy reductions in energy usage. And I think the jury is still out on that as a concept. But I wanted members to understand how different this is than we've done for, say, the last 100 years in pricing electricity for residential customers, and to consider whether you think the timing is right to make that radical of a change in state energy policy. So those are my concerns with the bill as it now reads, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Dr. Glahn? Representative Galen.
Thank you. My question is actually to Chair Hilty, but to this point, rate design was one of the things that we discussed in the 2007 bill as a kind of broader concept, and there have been a couple of key changes at the PUC related to, for instance, the SIP and incentive docket that was approved at the end of December this last year, and the pilot for inverted block rates that Director Glahn was referencing. And in our short conversation this morning, Director, I proposed to Director Glahn that the 2401 section 216B, because it states policy goals rather than is a clearer directive kind of foundational language to the Public Utilities Commission that I believe that the 0.03 section is, that the policy goal is represents in essence softer language or a softer location, and that the 216B03 really is more direct guidance to the Public Utilities Commission. I think that the A2 amendment makes sense for that reason, but I wanted to see, Chair Hilty, in your experience and as the author, if you agree with me that we're giving more direction rather than directive.
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I do agree with that. As you point out, we have had discussions both with the Public Utilities Commission and with XL Energy and to some extent with Minnesota Power regarding the question of rate design, which is already in current law. I would point out in response to Director Glahn that I believe his comments would be valid if what we were proposing to do is to have an inverted block rate for higher usage, but we're not proposing to do that here. This bill limits and merely encourages formation of a restructured rate for the lowest users to encourage less consumption at the residential level. That's all that this bill does. It does not discourage use that's related to commercial or industrial activity, which we recognize, of course, would increase along with increases in their activity. But what it does do is encourage conservation amongst those entities that are well positioned to practice conservation, as simply as turning off the light when you leave the room. And particularly, we want to do that to aid low-income users who certainly would benefit the most from that, being that typically the cost of utilities in their budget is a much higher percentage than it is for people of greater means. That's what this bill is attempting to accomplish, and I don't think that it's a threat to anybody to do that.
Representative Kalin, did you have a follow-up?
I'm willing to yield to Ms. Marshall first. It
looked like sure. Ms. Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple comments in response to Deputy Commissioner Glahn. First of all, it's important to know that since 1978, I believe, Minnesota Power has had an inverted block rate. So this doesn't represent a radical shift. We've had that. As you heard him mention, the commission has recently approved an inverted block rate for Center Point Gas, so that is part of a pilot, but it's a pilot because we've never done it for gas before, but we're currently doing that. So in the most recent natural gas rate case, the commission had approved an inverted block for residential class, and in the most recent Minnesota Power Electric case, voted to continue and maintain that inverted block rate structure. And one other thing is that inverted block rates are a unique tool. I mean, typically when we're working on the conservation side of the issue, we're putting upward pressure on folks' rates. When here, though, we've got a concept and a design that can, and a granted, and again, this is just strictly permissive, we've got a design that can promote both public policy objectives that are in statute, affordability and conservation, because there is a correlation between income and energy usage. And in, for example, within Minnesota Power's residential class, we know that 25% of their residential customers are using half of the residential average, and that those folks are disproportionately low and fixed income people. There's the correlation further that energy usage increases with income, and that's the other point here, that that demand is more elastic as you have higher use, and you're also talking about the folks with the resources who would actually make sense to invest in conservation measures.
Representative Kalin.
Just a brief comment, I think, to recognize Director Glahn's concerns more broadly about inverted block rates and the 216B03 section is one of the sections that is amended in the bill. I think that we will likely hear in mind the Ratepayer Protection Act to set up that process to really look at the Representative Beard's amendment Wednesday, it was, I think, on the RES costs and interim rate designs. We've heard a lot of things in this committee. I know the Senate has as well this year that deserve really rigorous analysis. I think Ms. Marshall's testimony goes to the point of how difficult and complex a lot of these issues and impact on rates and more specifically bills are. So I just wanted to make that comment that as I said to Director Glahn this morning, I'm happy to entertain language in the Ratepayer Protection Act and the stakeholder group that I hope we'll hear about that could include discussion specifically on inverted block rates and other rate design pieces. I know the commission has talked about sometimes and some thoroughly and some less thoroughly, and so I think that it's one of the things we really need to do to align our energy policy changes we've made in the last 10 years and our rates.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Representative Hilty.
I would just like to point out to members with respect to the testimony that we've had that we did adopt the A2 amendment, which deletes Section 1, which was a more broad reference to inverted block rates, and the bill as it's amended merely encourages utilities to use this among other tools in promoting their conservation programs.
Ms. Marshall, briefly, I know we have other people with questions.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair. In other words, we're not amending the reasonable rate statute, and we are not, there's no foregone conclusion that inverted block rates are reasonable. We're saying if a rate design can promote conservation, that's what we should do, or at least consider. Thank you.
Representative Beard, I believe you had a question.
Actually, Mr. Chair, the last comment pretty much addressed it. It was going to be to the thrust of the inverted block rates, but we did amend that out and made it a may instead of a you will, because my concern was if we take revenue out of the bottom end of the stream, it's got to be made up somewhere for regulated utilities. Where are they going to tack that on? Where are they going to make it up so they can hit their rate of return objectives? But apparently, since it isn't necessary and it becomes voluntary, my concern in that area could be assuaged. Thanks.
Further questions? Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chair, I've got an amendment if we're at a point to take amendments.
Actually, Representative Westrom, I'm going to ask if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to testify either for or against the bill so far. Seeing that there's no one coming down. Okay, Representative Westrom, let's move to your amendment if you'd be willing to offer it.
Mr. Chair, I will offer the A1 amendment.
Members, Representative Westrom offers the A1 amendment that is before us. Representative Hilty Representative Westrom, would you like to speak to your amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, I would. This is similar to a bill that's been introduced asserting states' rights, dealing with electricity policy and energy policy in our state and nation. And basically, it would assert our rights under the Article 1 of the Constitution as well as the 10th Amendment that if we make products in our state, sell them with just intrastate commerce within our state borders versus inter, which is across the country, we would have the right to make our own light bulbs and not ban the incandescent light bulb, which is the typical light bulb that we're mostly familiar with growing up. Members, that's in a nutshell what this bill would do. It would allow an entrepreneur to have that opportunity in Minnesota to possibly continue making the incandescent light bulb. I'll just share with you a little more information that's come about since I've been a co-author with Representative Erdahl on his bill. There's members in the deaf community that have contacted us and informed us that the non-incandescent light bulb, or the CFLs, I think is what they're called, that are mandated in 2012 to start replacing the incandescent light bulbs, do not work with the type of light systems that a lot of people who are deaf put in their house or could use in their house, which is, as I understand it, a blinking system that helps indicate to them if the baby is crying, if the doorbell is going off, or if there's other things they want warnings for. The incandescent light bulb works for that. The other light bulbs do not. That is a problem that apparently Congress hasn't thought of yet, and I think we should take the lead in doing that, along with asserting our state rights. The other thing that has come to Representative Erdahl's attention, he's actually had somebody in the state contact him, and they are close to a patent or working on an invention with an incandescent light bulb that is 65% more energy efficient than what we have today. And a large company that has at least expressed some interest in maybe manufacturing these kind of light bulbs, and this bill would give them the impetus to start doing that. And so let's lead the way of the nation in changing some of those policies and those light bulbs, and stop Thomas Edison probably from having to turn over in his grave, and lastly, assert our own state rights, as I think it's time we have the responsibility at the state to start stepping up and being responsible for our own actions and our own problems, and maybe it would be good that we all start getting back to the intention of the framers of the Constitution and take on some of these issues ourselves at the state level instead of the federal level. With that, Mr. Chair, I would urge members to support this amendment, and we can continue the debate.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Westrom. Representative Hilty, would you like to offer comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Westrom, I appreciate your effort to help me out by sending my simple bill to the Commerce Committee and the Committee on Civil Justice, among others. And I think that there was some significance in the number of times that you referred to this amendment as a bill, which indeed it would be. In fact, it strikes me that what we have here is two bills kind of rolled into one. Representative Westrom, you raised some interesting points about the incandescent light bulbs that I think people were not aware of before, although I believe there had been some ample opportunity for Representative Erdahl or you to make me aware of that prior to this morning. So Representative Westrom, I would be happy to continue the discussion with you at some point, but not on this bill and not this morning, and I would urge members to just vote no on the amendment.
Further discussion to the amendment. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like this amendment. I think it's a good idea, and I would urge members to vote for it with all due respect to the chair's feelings. I think it is an important issue that a lot of Minnesotans care about, and I appreciate Representative Westrom offering the amendment, and I know Representative Erdahl has been working hard on this as a bill and as amendment and as an amendment in other places. I think it's important. I think we should vote for it. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to request a roll call, please.
Roll call has been requested. Further discussion to Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, just a very short comment. I actually support the findings on Subdivision 1 broadly. I think the question I have is, or actually just more of a frustration, is that it's not a day late and a dollar short, but it's more like a decade late and a few billion short, because I wish that we would have heard this argument when No Child Left Behind, in essence, federalized our state education system and has really cost us billions of dollars. So I know that's actually a shared concern at this point. I wish that we had heard this a decade ago when that came up.
Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, this might broaden the scope of the bill, but I think Representative Westrom would think getting out of No Child Left Behind would be a friendly amendment to this.
and,
Members, I believe that's out of the purview of our committee.
And I wonder if Mr. Eliff, Mr. Chair, could prepare an amendment that would make it retroactive to 2001.
Members, I would like to remind you it is Friday as well. So, further discussion to this amendment? All right, roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no.
Hilty?
No.
Westrom?
Yes.
Anderson? Adkins? Beard?
Aye.
Bly?
No.
Breinert?
No.
Gunther? Hackbarth? Hoppe?
Aye.
Fortman? Johnson? Kalen?
Nah.
Knuth?
No.
Kulik Jackson?
Aye.
Magnus? Nornis? Obermueller?
No.
Purcell? Saylor?
No.
Seifert?
Aye.
Welty?
Aye.
Just to let people know, I guess the absence, they would have had it, but they don't count. So there being eight nays and six ayes, the amendment does not prevail, or the motion does not prevail. Representative Hilty, would you like to offer closing comments?
I would just renew my motion that House File 3493, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Mr. Chair, I ask a roll call.
Roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll on the bill as amended. Chair votes aye.
Hilty?
Aye.
Westrom?
No.
Anderson? Adkins? Beard?
Nay.
Bly?
Aye.
Breinert?
Aye.
Gunther? Hackbarth? Hoppe?
Nay.
Fortman? Johnson? Kalen?
Yep.
Knuth?
Yes.
Kulik Jackson?
Yes.
Magnus? Nornis? Obermueller?
Aye.
Purcell? Saylor?
Aye.
Seifert?
No.
Welty?
No.
There being nine ayes and five nays, the bill is passed to the general register as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Hilty, to your next bill, would you like to move that and have it before us?
I would, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 3667 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Members, that motion is before us. Representative Hilty moves that House File 3667 be recommended to pass to the general register. Discussion to that motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty.
House File 3667 is a bill that would extend the time that Minnesota Power would have to implement its mercury emission reduction plan at Boswell 4, which is one of its coal-fired power plants. Minnesota Power has already completed its mandated Boswell 3 mercury reduction plan ahead of schedule and made voluntary mercury reductions at its Taconite Harbor facility, which was recently acquired. And the reason for the extension is basically that members may be aware Minnesota Power has been involved in some contentious rate cases in the recent past, and it is felt that given the uncertainty about what regulations may be presenting themselves to us in the next short while, that it would be a relief to the ratepayers of Minnesota Power as well as to the company to postpone the currently required implementation of the Boswell 4 project for a determined amount of time, which in this bill would be 3 years. And Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment to the bill that I need to offer to put the bill in its proper order. Mr. Chair, I believe that would be the, sort through my papers here, the A4 amendment, which actually just incorporates two earlier amendments that have been distributed. So, Mr. Chair, I would move the H3667A4 amendment.
Members, Representative Hilty has moved the A4 amendment before us. Discussion to that? We've add that. Anybody else? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hilty to the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I would, I have with me at the witness table Ms. Margaret Hodnick from Minnesota Power, who I would ask to describe the situation for the members.
Sure.
Representative Westrom.
Just for Mr. Representative Hilty, I know members on our side are quite supportive, so depending upon the committee's appetite, we don't need a lot of testimony, I don't think, if other members are comfortable as well. Just to give you that heads up.
Thank you for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I pointed that out to Ms. Hodnick the other day, and hopefully she has that well in mind.
Ms. Hodnick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Falk and members of the committee. I've been getting the message about being concise, so I will certainly do that and open to answer any other questions.
If you would, please state your name for the record as well.
My name is Margaret Hodnick, and I'm the Vice President of Regulatory and Legislative Affairs for Minnesota Power.
Thank you,
Chair. As Representative Hilty has said, Minnesota Power is requesting permission to postpone its mercury emission reduction project at Boswell 4. And Minnesota Power has already completed the mandated mercury reduction at its Boswell 3 unit. We applied for that 2 years prior to the requirement in the statute and actually completed that project 1 year early. So we've been ahead of time on the Boswell 3 project. However, we've had several rate cases and other rate rider increases, and with the economy the way it is, we've been getting a lot of feedback about our rates increasing. There's also, as Chair Hilty mentioned, federal regulations pending on a number of emissions that could affect this unit, and we're concerned that if we moved ahead in the time frame specified in the statute, we would be possibly installing the mercury equipment and then having to come back in later and take that equipment out to come in and do other emissions, so it could lead to a waste of capital investment on behalf of our ratepayers, and we would like to avoid that. So we're respectfully requesting permission to extend the timing of this implementation. And there's an outside date for how far we can extend that, and we must file a report annually on the status of the unit, the status of regulations and technology that we would possibly use in it, so that stakeholders can stay apprised of our status and ask any questions they wish between now and the time we complete the project. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Hodnick? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe to Representative Hilty, and I don't necessarily want to drag the PUC guys down here, but you know, when we passed this rule, this legislation several years ago, one of the things that we were led to believe was in it was the ability for PUC to waive some of this these requirements if in their estimation the impact to the rate utilities or the rate payers or the utilities was so strong, so severe, that we'd be better served by either forestalling or waiving the requirement. Has that been your experience, Ms. Hodnick, in dealing with PUC on this, or is it important that you come here and actually have us give you legislative relief? Is it not forthcoming at the PUC?
Ms. Hodnick.
Chair Falk, Representative Beard, the current statute mandates that a Mercury project be implemented at Boswell Ford. So the commission is under legislative statute to mandate a Mercury project specifically. And we're concerned that that's the only requirement on this unit, and we anticipate there will be other federal requirements that are going to come in the next number of years, and we'd like to do it all at one time and do the most economical project for our customers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought it was just important for us to discuss that, particularly as we move ahead with the discussion about what the Mercury and the renewable energy standards are actually hitting, costing the ratepayers in another bill we'll be talking about, and you'll find me very supportive of Chair Hilty's bill here. Thanks.
Further questions for Ms. Hodnick? Seeing none, Ms. Hodnick, thank you. I believe that Mr. Bill Grant would like to speak to the bill. Mr. Grant, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League, and I did want to make the committee aware of a couple of points. First of all, we are concerned about this bill. We are concerned about efforts to extend the deadline, particularly, and to Representative Beard's point, when the current legislation does allow the commission to get grant two one-year extensions. That language is in the bill or in the legislation now. Xcel Energy, as another example of a utility that's under this same mandate, has submitted a plan to the Pollution Control Agency for what they are going to do at their Sherco 1 and 2 units, which are similarly wet scrubbed units. And they've indicated, I think appropriately, that whereas the plan they've submitted would be what they would do today if they were to install equipment today, that they are still monitoring the situation and may, in fact, return to the commission and the Pollution Control Agency and submit a different plan before the regulation goes into effect. I'm not clear why a similar path for Minnesota Power wouldn't be just as appropriate. Having said all that, I have worked very closely with Ms. Hodnick and the company to develop the language in Subdivision 2 of the bill relating to, it's the language beginning at 119 through 211 to annually report on where we are with things. I agree with Ms. Hodnick that there's a great deal of uncertainty right now out there for all utilities, not only with respect to mercury, but also with respect to a number of other pollutants and potentially carbon dioxide. For that reason, we understand that we may want to continue evaluating whether or not these kinds of investments today would make sense in light of future developments. And in fact, whether or not, as indicated on lines 2.5 and 2.6, whether we should be considering other alternatives to the continued operation of the plant in its current formulation should go forward at all. And I'm happy that we've added that language. I think it addresses a number of my concerns. I do, though, want to make it clear, though, that I have a concern about a six-year extension when the current legislation already allows for extensions.
Questions for Mr. Grant? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Grant.
Thank you.
Anyone from the audience wish to come down, speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Hilty, would you like to renew your motion?
I would, Mr. Chair, renew my motion that House File 3667, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Members, that motion is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed to the general register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty, did you have additional comments?
No, Mr. Chair. I don't think a motion would be required in order for the committee to adjourn, but that would be my suggestion.
Our committee assistant would like the members to know that we will not be meeting on Monday. So with that, the committee is adjourned.